Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode is brought to you by GoToMyPC. You know, a typical work week used to be, what was it, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Times have changed. Most of us are spending more and more hours stuck in the office. You're missing out probably on some important family events, putting off your personal life. That's why I recommend GoToMyPC to access your office computer from home, so you don't have to be at the office to get your work done. Work at home early and late in the morning during weekends, after you're done with things you want and need to do. Our listeners can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days. That's a month of unlimited remote access for free, and I recommend it highly. For the special offer, go to www.gotomypc/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free trial. And we thank GoToMyPC for sponsoring this show. Good day. It's Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We are on episode number 136. It is almost Thanksgiving. The leaves are turning just all sorts of beautiful colors. And we are seeing storms. Did you see that storm, that recent storm we saw, that hurricane? Unbelievable, the amount of rain that fell. And besides that, though, think about it for a second. We really had a pretty light hurricane season. Hurricane season is over. But you know what it is? It's time for stone crabs. As a matter of fact, I went down to Joe Stone Crab last week. Have you ever been there? What a great place. An institution, been around for, I think, 80 years or so, and still serving and providing the same quality food. This is not a commercial. But, boy, I had some great stone crabs down there. And, you know, my family, we go down there, you know, special events. It's not a cheap place. But we went down there, and really the stone crabs are great, but the sides, I mean, they're cream spinach, and they're potatoes Lyonnaise, and they have the hash browns that come in kind of a pile and all crispy on the outside. I got to tell you something, that is just some combination for a dinner. And getting in this, here's what's interesting about that. Usually when you go to Joe Stone Crab, you have to pony up a few bucks and take care of them in the front, if you know what I'm saying. Otherwise, you may wait, especially on a Saturday night. You can wait 3 hours. I'm just not the kind of guy, you know me, I am not the kind of guy that waits 3 hours for a table. Not because I'm special, but I just don't have the patience. And I would much rather, you know, do a little something and do my fair share of taking care of who I need to get into that restaurant. So it costs you a couple of bucks. What does it cost you? 20 bucks? 30 bucks? Maximum, you know, get in within 20. Well, here's what happened. When I say I got right in, I mean I got right in. Not because I'm anybody, nothing like that. But you know what? You could blow a cannonball through that place. It was amazing that there was so little people that were actually there at about 5:30, 6 o'clock. Now, that's early for dinner most of the time, but at Joe's, it's not terribly early, especially for a Sunday night. And it did get a bit more crowded towards about 7, but I was pretty surprised compared to other times I've been there, even on Sunday nights, that it wasn't as crowded. And I wondered if it was something to do with the Miami area that we were in. We're clearly in season now, and I was really wondering if it had something to do, and obviously it did have something to do with the economy that was causing the situation. Talking about the economy, I want to tell you a few things that are going on in terms of the economic numbers that came out this week. I want to tell you about a stock that we have recently picked up, and I want to talk to you about that and give you some of the reasons why and direct you to a commentary on where we're talking about that. And I also want to direct you to our guest today. We have a great guest. You've had him on. You've heard him before. His name is Tyler. We'll go by that, and he writes for the blog Zero Hedge. He is the gentleman who really blew the can off of a lot of things that were going on in terms of the flash trading, high-frequency trading, really got down and dirty into much of the TARP issues that were going on. We're going to talk a little bit about that. This week we had some interesting, more than interesting. It was probably one of the best shows on this week when Treasury Secretary Geithner went in front of Congress and was just obliterated. I mean, he was taken apart to a point that he was asked to resign. And one of the congressmen said that no, he didn't want Geithner to be fired. He should have never been hired in the first place, and really kind of rolled up the sleeves and got down and dirty. In fact, Timothy Geithner also came back with a few shots, saying that it wasn't his problem, that this budget is what it is, and that many of the things that they're dealing with in the Treasury are so, it's because Congress voted for them. So they were jibbing and jabbing, and they were throwing back all sorts of insults. It was kind of interesting to watch. Hope you enjoyed that, or at least looked at that. But we'll talk with Tyler in a little while, talking about that, some of the banking issues, which he knows really well, and some of the things that are going on that you need to be aware of. He is always looking at some really interesting and sometimes obscure areas when it comes to the markets and gives us answers. And I talk to him quite frequently to kind of wrap my hands around what is going on when things just look, you know, kind of out there. So let's talk a little bit about, for a moment, some of the economics that we saw this week and last week. In total, I could say that it was probably pretty disappointing. This is what we expected to happen. You know, we're calling for a bit of a double dip towards the end of, towards the middle of 2010. We'll say starting somewhere in the, I'll give you a range right now because we have to quantify this a little better. But in the May to June, July, somewhere around there, there could be a double dip on the economy. Now, the stock market will obviously start to look forward and in advance. And some of it has to do with the manufacturing and inventory restocking cycle. What we've seen recently is a lot of disappointments. We saw, for example, this week, industrial production was supposed to be up by 0.4%. First of all, it was revised down from last month. It was only up 0.1%. We saw that the producer price index was starting to inch up a little bit in some areas when we X out the food and energy. But yet, when we look on a year-over-year basis, it's down in a deflationary move, negative 1.9%. Not good. The housing market index came out soft. Consumer price indexes, though, inflation back to the consumer was a little bit high. But then we also saw the housing starts were the lowest they were since 1959. Building permits were pathetic, down from 570 last to 552,000 housing starts, if you will. Initial jobless claims are still over 500,000. Continuing claims over close to 6 million. And leading indicators were really disappointing this week as well when we saw them at 0.3%. The prior was 1% up, and they expected 0.4. Probably the only thing that was exciting and that we could say that was good was the Philadelphia Fed. The Philly Fed Business Conditions Index came in at 16. They expected about 12, and that's good, and it's actually up from 11 last period. But if we go down the list and we look at all the different things this month that we've seen, it really has been a disappointment from the University of Michigan Confidence, which came in at 66 from 71 expectation, and lower than last period. So what's happening is we're no longer seeing this less bad situation. We're not really seeing stabilization. We're really seeing unstabilization. We're really seeing less good here. We're really seeing the opposite of this. We're not going to see that in the press because they don't talk that way. They only want to see the silver lining. But we're really seeing things go the opposite direction right now across the board. And stocks are reflecting that. We've seen earnings come out from Dell that came in, I got to tell you, it was one of the worst quarters I've seen from them in a while. They missed both on the top and the bottom line and drove the stock down over about 9, 10%. We saw stocks left and right in the retail, some moving up, some moving down. There was kind of a demarcation and really you had to be more refined in which retailer you were picking this time. And a lot of retailers were looking a bit better, but some of them were looking quite concerning. We are holders of Walmart. They are coming out with, I got to tell you something. Talk about the 500-pound gorilla coming out swinging. These guys are coming out and slashing the prices of toys by 60%. Major deals on DVDs, Blu-rays, and on flat panel, big, small flat panels. Why? They want to bring you in. It's kind of like, I'll say it's a loss leader in a way, but what's happening is they've expanded their inventory. We wrote a whole piece about this on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You need to see that. But we'll put a link in the show notes. But what Walmart is doing is brilliant. They're basically saying that we are going after the competition. We're going to poach as much as we can from the competition right now because we have the inventory. We have the pricing power. We just made a deal with our smaller to mid-size distributors, the people that are giving them their goods because they can't get credit. You know, the bankruptcy of CIT a couple of weeks back really constrained the credit when it came to the smaller businesses out there. So Walmart said, you know what? What we're going to do is we're going to allow you, small businesses, mid-sized business, the people that we're working with, to actually utilize the credit rating of Walmart in order to, you know, back up any of the things that you need to do in your business. Brilliant move. Walmart now has them under their control. They can put pricing pressure on them or say, you know what, fine, don't work with us, and we're not going to let you utilize our credit rating. Utilizing Walmart's credit rating will open some doors and allow them to get the much-needed funds they need in this very tight credit environment. So now this is going on. They really have all angles, you know, really covered. They've expanded into all sorts of areas, from landscaping to food to bicycles and toys, electronics. I mean, they have manicure and pedicure places and hairstylists and banks. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. You just have to go into a Walmart and it's really one-stop shopping right now. So when you look at the environment that you're in right now and you see like a Walmart as an example, and they're really picking up. Have you seen the chart on them lately? I mean, the chart is looking beautiful. We have a really great gain on them, you know, when everybody else is kind of saying, Walmart, what can happen? Well, if you really think about the market right now, people looking for bargains, at least they're looking to be a little bit more frugal when it comes to their shopping for the holidays. And we think that Walmart's kind of an interesting play right now. It may be boring to some. Sure, maybe you want to look at, you know, some of the high flyers, but look at some of them lately. I mean, look at, kind of a specialty retailer like Green Mountain Coffee, down a ton lately. So, you look at the Buckle, for example, which we liked for a while, but just fell off a cliff. It's really a difficult environment because when you look at the teen retailers, there's that demarcation. ARO, Aeropostale, was great for a while. Now A&F has come back, Abercrombie & Fitch, and their, you know, numbers look really good. Their sales weren't great, no, but their net numbers, they're managing their inventory exceptionally well. And, you know, you have to give them credit for that in this kind of environment where people are just not reaching very deep because there's no depth in the pocketbooks when we're coming to a time we have 10.2% unemployment. So, you know, right now it's kind of a really interesting time that we need to be careful of because there's so many bulls out there. Bullish percent index is at a, you know, a record high, higher than it was before the correction back in 2007. That is a contrary indicator as we see it. At the same time, we're seeing volume tail off to almost nothing except on days where the sell-offs, and those days are kind of rough on the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange. We're seeing a lot of volume come in. So a lot of things going on that we need to be aware of right now. Let me give you a quick down and dirty. We like Discovery. Oh, let me say something before I say that. Have you gone to the Podcast Awards site yet? Podcastawards.com. You can actually vote once a day. Here's what's amazing. We made the People's Choice Award. We have for the Disciplined Investor. We're in the Business Award, at least the nomination for the Disciplined Investor and DH Unplugged. And the winning investor is under educational. So what you have to do, please, I ask you, please go over to Podcast Awards. Tell your friends, tweet it, retweet it, put it up on your Facebook. Go to Podcast Awards, vote for the Disciplined Investor for the People's Choice and or for the DH Unplugged for Business, whatever you choose, and the winning investor. And you could vote once per day, which is kind of neat, but you can only do it through, I think, the 30th of November. So it would mean a lot to me if you do so. And while we're on the topic of doing that, you know, it's a great time to buy some holiday gifts. You know that The Disciplined Investor, my book, is available on audible.com for download or on iTunes. And you could also get it at Amazon for like $13 or something like that. It's also available on the Kindle, just to let you know. So for $13, I always say, I mean, if you can't get one good idea from that, I mean, $13, come on. That's the cost of one trade, one mistrade. Let's go and talk about Discovery for just a moment. And I have a link that goes over some of the technicals and the fundamentals. Oprah Winfrey is leaving, as we heard, she's leaving the network that she's on currently, her show, and she is going to be moving to the Discovery, not for the show necessarily, but she's going to do something in a partnership with Discovery. That's the channel that has the Lobster Man and the various Dirty Jobs and all those great documentaries and some of the real, I guess the difference is that when you look at the real life TV and the reality shows that are set up versus these shows, I mean, you're kind of looking at a much different animal. These are the kind of the shows that are really, for the most part, Dirty Jobs is one of them, and The Chefs. And it has a great following. They have an unbelievable amount of revenue from advertising. And now with Oprah moving to the Discovery Channel, or at least being part of that, it's going to be kind of interesting. One of the things that we did see is we own Comcast as well. CMCSA is the symbol. We own them because what we like about them is that, the revenue is good. More and more is moving to cable. They have an opportunity for content through. We know that NBC may be coming aboard. They actually did something with Ticketmaster recently for more content and more spreading of their revenue opportunities. But Discovery, symbol DISCA, it's moved up a lot lately. We've tried to get this a few times, and we missed it. And we're not going to be as greedy trying to grab it down. We're going to take a small position in this, 60% debt, market cap at about $8.8 billion. Average 50-day volumes, about 1.6 million, pretty good. Short interest, about 2.7 days. 29 PE, a little bit hot, but they have great revenue opportunity. Listen to this. 2000 EPS was 86 cents a share. 2009 estimates about 129, and 2010 about 158. Only about 283 million shares outstanding. But you'll look at this, and when you look at the chart, the stochastics are a little bit rolling over here, and you'd expect that. But they're running very nicely on its 20-day and its 50-day. So the 20-day keeps on rolling off of, which is about 30, what is it now? 20-day, about 29.75 is the 20-day. And right about where it is now, give or take a couple of pennies. The 50-day is on the moving average is 29.63, so it's about, you know, pretty close. We picked it up, you know, close to here. It's trading at about 31 right now. So we think the downside probably is close to its 50-day right now. We think that the support, and if you look at the channel of the trend line, if you draw a trend line, and I put a chart on the site and in the link that we'll show you there. But, you know, we're talking about that the 50-day is at 29.64, 200-day is at 22.75. Not to be boring you, we're buying it down to the support level. We'll continue buying it, and we'll stop it out if it breaks below that by about 3, 4%. So we're talking about somewhere about a buck and a half lower than the 29. So 27 and a half. If it breaks to that, that's probably a point that we want to think about, you know, kind of lessening our position and being very alert to it. But we think there's a great opportunity here, especially with the tens of millions of people that are going to probably be getting cable because Oprah's only going to be available in that starting in a couple of years. And that move is going to start, and it's going to start to steamrolling. And I think when people realize the revenue opportunity from that, it's going to be quite remarkable. So we like Discovery. We like Comcast as well. And so check that out. What else was I going to tell you about? We talked about the economics. We talked about Discovery. We talked about the podcast awards. We talked about all this good stuff. Okay. You know what? We're going to take a quick break. And I think that the only thing I want you to do is remember that if you want to look at, I always get these emails. You know, where is the virtual tour? Here's the deal. Go to the show notes. We have show notes on this episode. And go to the show notes for this episode. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click show notes, and you'll find a link on the bottom that says virtual tour, and check it out. There's a 14-minute virtual tour, the virtual tour of me talking you through how we manage money, $50,000 minimum. And if you want to do that, just check it out. And when we get back, we're going to queue it up with Zero Hedge. Should be a really enjoyable discussion. And talking about a lot of things that I know you're going to want to hear. So stick around. This is Andrew Horowitz again, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for coming aboard today and listening. Just hold on 1 second. Quick musical interlude while we set up the phones and get it on with Zero Hedge, Tyler Durden from the Zero Hedge website. We'll be right back. I hope you enjoyed that quick break. We are now on with Tyler Durden, and he is, if you don't know that name, by the way, of course, you probably do recognize it from Fight Club. And Tyler goes under that, we'll just say under that name, as we're trying to keep a lower profile because some of the things that he talks about is pretty intense, and you know, some of the things he needs to do is maintain his anonymity. But he writes for the Zero Hedge, which is a site that we love. It uncovers a lot of really interesting areas, and whether it comes to the stock market or when it comes to various brokerages. So I welcome my friend Tyler. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, thank you.
So let's start talking about this. There's so much to talk about. I mean, we haven't talked in a little while, but now I talked about this earlier in the podcast. Geithner is under the gun asking, I don't know if it's a little bit of grandstanding by some of these congressmen, but, you know, they're asking for his resignation. Do you think that has any, I mean, seriously, does it have any real merit?
Well, you know, I think it's more of a political question than an economic or financial one.
Right.
Obviously, it makes for good theater. That's a given. We have seen politics get involved kind of at the intersection of Wall Street and Main Street in the past. I think the most recent example, of course, was the AIG situation and the whole bonus fiasco where, you know, there was a whole lot of, you know, ado about pretty much nothing at the end of the day. In many ways, a lot of the cynics out there believe that this is simply a way to kind of blow off some of the pent-up anger at people at the administration who especially in, following the Sigtarp report on AIG, which essentially put the entire blame on Tim Geithner. That is a way to get the public anger out there in the public, you know, kind of more of a psychological issue than anything. The real question, of course, vis-a-vis Tim Geithner's political career, in my opinion, will have to do with just the overall performance of the economy over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months heading into the midterm elections. Some of the other cynics in the economic domain think that basically Mr. Geithner will be the scapegoat in the situation where there isn't any dramatic improvement in employment, or rather unemployment, and that if push came to shove, that he would be basically first in the sacrificial altar, if you will.
Well, somebody's got to be put up there, it seems, because we can't let the real people who are damaging things go down, you know? You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, you've been pretty negative on the economy. I don't think I've ever really seen anything positive, per se. But give me this. Would you agree that there was a little time there that things were getting a little bit better from where they were? And what I mean is, I'm not trying to be, you know, politically correct or all for the media, but saying that, you know, things were pretty much at a standstill, at a stop, the old falling off the cliff discussion. And then things at least did, I hate using the word stabilize, but they did at least stop falling for a little while there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, no, I totally agree with that. My personal opinion on the economy, frankly, it's not that it's, you know, negative above all else. You have to put things into perspective, which is that over the past year, we have seen the most unprecedented, you know, deposition of liquidity, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, and of stimulus payments. In other words, both a monetary and a fiscal stimulus in the economy, which do not have parallels with anything all the way back to the Great Depression. So if you put all those together, it is inevitable that you will see a rebound in the economy one way or another. The real question, and the question that, for example, Jan Hatzius of Goldman Sachs, their head economist, has been posing more and more recently, is just how sustainable is this so-called one-time benefit that we have already, in many estimations, seen the peak of. In other words, yes, we have seen a pickup in GDP. You know, preliminary estimates for Q3 GDP are at 3.5%. People believe that at further readings and as more information emerges, that this number actually will be trimmed down. However, the biggest question mark is what happens, not so much in Q4, which probably will not be a big disappointment, but how will 2010 proceed? And, you know, now more so than ever, the biggest wild card is becoming China. And what will really happen to China, which in many ways is almost an identical situation with America, courtesy of both the renminbi peg as well as their comparable liquidity and fiscal stimulus that they're experiencing almost on a record basis.
I mean, do you think that China could be, you know, there's a lot of talk about China manipulating the dollar, the yuan, the renminbi, but do you think it's possible that China could be part of the process of pushing down the dollar? I mean, that's good for them overall, since they're pegged, of course. Do you think that's something that is being done, the currency moves that we're seeing? I mean, and almost on a daily basis, the really ridiculous moves on currency, clearly that's affecting markets, which is odd in itself. But do you think that it's being done because of that, so you don't have to say that you're manipulating your own currency?
Well, if you boil it down to the lowest common denominator, basically what happens is because of the peg, a weaker dollar, as you pointed out, benefits China. That's, you know, not debatable. Many people have even said that China has been adopting mercantilist policies. You know, we'll not necessarily go into that debate. But, you know, simplistically, and the reason why a lot of Chinese competitors in Asia and a lot of the other exporting countries are very unhappy about this is because, obviously, a weak renminbi has a huge benefit to the Chinese export economy. And while America, for example, doesn't benefit as much from a weak currency, courtesy of the fact that our manufacturing base has been decimated.
Because we don't sell anything anymore, is that why?
That's exactly correct. However, who does benefit is China. Right. And because of the peg, because of the almost parallel response to the crisis between America and China, one of the recurring themes that I have pointed out on Zero Hedge has been the fact that in many ways, courtesy of this, you know, being jointed at the hip, as I put it, between between China and the U.S., the two countries almost have the same monetary and fiscal goals. And, you know, the question is whether or not this, you know, duopoly of China and America can basically continue this undecoupling phase, whereas everybody, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago was harping on the decoupling. Now it's essentially completely the opposite. And in many ways, either China is, you know, the 51st state of the U.S., or, you know, we are province X of China.
Well, actually, if I may interrupt for a second, if you think about it just for a moment, it's kind of interesting because if you put China and you put the U.S., and you can add some of the other countries like Brazil and all, but let's talk about China. If you put China and the U.S. next to each other and you say, okay, who's going to benefit from the lower dollar and, you know, that concept, the truth is that China is totally benefiting. So they're kind of, if in fact they are doing it in a way like we're doing it, if they've adopted the weak dollar, even though, of course, from everybody out there, the strong dollar policy is really in the best interest. I mean, I can't stand this discussion. You know, the strong dollar policy is in the best interest of America, but yet at the same time, you know, quantitative easing and all the stimulus, et cetera, that goes on, and the money that's being spent is obviously, you know, they know it's weakening the dollar. But
sure,
China,
sure,
in the end, is the benefactor of all of this, because really they are the ones that are exporting and we're buying their price. So it's a double whammy for us.
No, you're absolutely correct. I would also add that a weak dollar for the U.S. is actually, you know, an additional benefit, because it obviously, looking at the correlation between the stock market and the dollar, which, has, if you were to read, I believe, Mr. Rosenberg, David Rosenberg, had a very good letter, I believe 2 days ago, so probably the 18th of November, in which he discussed that while historically the correlation between the dollar and the market is effectively nil, lately it has gone up all the way to 0.98, which is just, you know, a ludicrous combination.
It's ridiculous. You know what I watched today? The whole week I was watching, I should say, the tick, you know, the tick measurement of let's just call it the buying pressure, selling pressure, essentially the advanced decline.
Yeah.
And I was watching the dollar index next to it. It was scarily similar.
Correct. So, and you know, you're absolutely right. That's more the actual trading level. But from a macro perspective, the U.S. benefits, and not so much the U.S., but really the top 5-10 percentile of the U.S. population, which actually does have a lot of their liquid net worth invested in stocks. And another thing to keep in mind is that those 10% of the population who are being targeted to, you know, basically generate a lot of capital gains courtesy of a dropping dollar, they are the ones that spend roughly 45% of all consumer dollars. And again, as we all know, consumers make up 75% of the GDP. Not only that, but they also make up roughly 60%, I believe, of federal taxable revenue. So, on one hand, the Obama administration is promoting a weak dollar courtesy, even, you know, contrary to what Mr. Geithner and Mr. Bernanke would say on a day-to-day basis, which, of course, does benefit China and does benefit its cheap exporting base, which in turn helps Walmart and the lower class in America to buy, you know, cheap stuff at Walmart and other discount stores. But it also benefits the top crust of U.S. society, those people who do have a lot of their assets tied up in with the stock market. So on whose back is really all of this, you know, occurring? Because obviously for every winner, you must have a loser. And
we're the loser.
You know, the theme,
we're the loser.
Well, the loser is the middle class in America, basically,
but
nobody else.
But wait,
I
just had another thought. I need to flush this out for a second. This is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Because in addition to the fact that the weak dollar benefits in China, in our example, we're also buying most of our goods from them, or around the country, but a lot of goods from them. So we're giving them the dollars. Since they're pegged at this point, and we know that the fact is their dollar should be, their currency should be a lot stronger than it is. We know that. Essentially, if you were to break that peg, if you were to take a scissor and just snap it, if you will, it would snap all the way back up. I mean, it would be like the Brazilian currency, the real, that has gone, what is it, up 60% this year against the dollar? Some ridiculous number,
right?
So it would snap. So in a sense, what we're doing is they're not buying any goods from us. They're not bringing any money into us. They're putting the money into the treasuries, which are dollar denominated, by the way. Although I've seen recently they started slowing down on that. If you look at the TIC data, not the TICK, but the TIC data in Bloomberg, which
the
I know
TIC,
you have.
Yes.
We actually put up a post today about that and looked at the trends of that. And trends are clearly higher from treasury buying, but China is slowing down. And what's interesting is we're giving them our dollars and we're buying products from them. So what we're doing in a sense is, and they're buying and hoarding commodities. They're doing it at this low level. They put it into their currency and we're handing them all of our currency at these low rates. You snap that line that I just said and boy, are they sitting pretty.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And we should probably touch on the topic that you discussed about the TIC data and, you know, what exactly is China really purchasing at this point. But you're correct that they do sit on a huge dollar-denominated foreign reserve base, which up to now has been mostly basically reshuffled back in the U.S. in the form of treasuries, and up until last year, mortgage-backed securities, although they've been selling like crazy out of the MBS and agency market, which is actually another topic for discussion. But the other major, obviously, theme over the past 2-3 months has been the emergence of gold as an alternative to the U.S. dollar, and obviously India.
Oh, well, that was big. Now, that was unbelievable, huh?
Well, that was obviously a scary case example of I guess how developing countries and how these economies in overdrive are approaching the dollar. It wasn't so much a diversification play on their existing asset base, as it is really a way to send a message to the U.S. That people are very, very worried about what the long-term viability of the dollar is, as both as a reserve currency and as a viable investable product by countries like India. The real question is what would happen to the price of gold if China were to actually, or if it were to be made public that China is buying gold.
Well, explain to everybody what happened with India. Explain, because I don't think everybody knows about this. What happened was, 3-4 weeks ago or so? Explain what happened.
Well, roughly about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, the IMF announced that they are going to be selling roughly 400 tons or whatever the maximum allowable amount of gold that they can sell in any given calendar year. And one can wonder whether they're doing this because all of their bailout practices have kind of been a huge cash drain. We don't know. Frankly, we don't care. Although with Eastern Europe being kind of on the brink every single day, that would be a probably logical assumption. What happened, like you pointed out, 3 weeks ago, it was made public that India had bought, I believe, half of the total amount that the IMF had been selling. And the reason why this is surprising is because the IMF usually comes out every year or so with a comparable statement, which basically says, we're going to be selling gold, et cetera. And a lot of the quote-unquote gold bug community out there usually sees this as a way to push the price of gold down. In other words,
there's more on the market.
Exactly. There is more of kind of gold amounts in the market, and that in some ways it's almost the IMF calling the bluff on central banks to, tell the U.S., tell the IMF, tell whoever that the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. What India did was unique is because never before has a central bank really gone out and really called a big seller's bluff, to the degree that that India did several weeks ago. And not only that, but, tiny island of Mauritius, I believe a week ago, did the same thing. They bought only 2 tons of gold. But another thing to note is that the price at which these transactions occurred were, I believe, roughly $1,070 per ounce in the India case and $1,135 in the Mauritius case. So gradually, central banks are becoming more and more oblivious as to what the price that they actually transact at is, and simply are trying to find ways to roll their dollar holdings into something tangible. And, at this point, we get into the whole debate of, what is the real value of gold and does it even have any gold value?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
That can be, a multi-hour discussion on its own.
Yeah, we've talked about
but,
that.
another thing to keep in mind is, for example, Russia also did the same thing. I believe it was made public a few days ago that instead of selling gold, Russian Central Bank, or the Russian Central Bank, as it had announced previously, was in fact buying 50 tons of gold or so, if I'm not mistaken. So there has been a pretty concerted effort by a lot of the central banks out there to diversify their assets, and you know, more so than anything, this is a blow to the dollar, and this is a blow to not only the U.S. administration, but it's a blow to Geithner and Bernanke's policy of quote unquote keeping the dollar strong, which is what they attest to doing. But you know, obviously, looking at the dollar chart, it's
it doesn't look that way. Let me switch gears with you for a second and talk about some of the benchmarks, some of the victories that the administration has to look at. In other words, they're saying, okay, well, if we can bring unemployment down, if we can bring the housing market up, if we can bring GDP up, GDP can be manipulated very easily, especially from the low base. I think we both agree with that. Because basically, you just throw in manufacturing, like cash for clunkers, cash for appliances are coming. You know, you throw in stimulus in certain areas, and it's going to naturally pump it up.
Yes.
The other thing that's interesting and they could look at is the housing. And you could say, okay, well, how many housing starts or how many mortgage applications? Forget pending sales. That's kind of crap, obviously. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But, you know, we could look at how many are in that area. We can look at unemployment rates and things of that nature. Well, on the first case, on the unemployment, we know that whatever's going on, and not to totally chastise the administration, it's only been a number of months, and the unemployment rate is far beyond where they thought it was going to be at the worst-case scenario. Which brings me up to the stress test, which we'll talk about in a moment. But the second thing is the housing market is not doing well. As a matter of fact, it's reminiscent of the cash for clunkers, where right after were you tickled when the cash for clunkers was going on and then they were starting to immediately project they were back to a 14 million annual car sale rate?
They did in fact hit a 14 million SAR rate, but subsequent, you know, to August in September, I believe it dropped right to 9.1 million. So you had a huge variation. Now, you know, you bring up a very good point. You know, it's easy to obviously derive short-term benefits to GDP. The cost of cash for clunkers was, you know, $10 billion. And the benefit from cash for clunkers in Q3 GDP alone was roughly 1.5%.
Well, just for everybody's interest, why did he just say $10 billion? Did he make a mistake? No, he didn't make a mistake. Was it really $3 billion? Yes, it was $3 billion, but it was in the form of tax credits. And you probably have to also add in the salvage cost of that, which I bet you is on top of the $10 billion, right? Of the cars. But basically, when you look at the tax credit of it and how much the government has to pay, it's not a one-for-one. I think the estimation was something like $20,000 plus per car for the cash for clunkers deal.
Yeah, and if you recall, the White House actually got into a bit of a spat with Edmunds.com, which did
that was ugly. That was ugly.
I have never actually seen an administration get into a direct valuation fight.
Well, they're like bloggers. I mean, look what happened with Fox. You know, the Fox, they weren't going to allow the Fox into the newsroom. And I got to tell you something. I commend the rest of the news world. Maybe they did it out of fear of their own situation, but for saying that if Fox isn't allowed in this conference, we're not coming either. Across the board, I think that was very commendable. Seriously, I mean, they could have made it really miserable for Fox.
No, I last thing I wanted to do is discuss politics, but I believe that at some levels the administration has done some very amateur mistakes when it comes to handling public opinion. And in many ways, it's almost comparable to how Goldman Sachs has been approaching criticism. And some of the very rudimentary PR mistakes that they have also expressed.
You buy off their friendship is what you do. That's the hope.
Correct.
Which I guess goes through that's the administration and Goldman. Right?
Well, obviously there are people who allege that there is a very close relationship between the two entities. I do discuss a lot of the presumed connections on Zero Hedge, which, for better or worse, unfortunately, do present themselves more often than not. But the question is, in the long run, does America benefit from this very close relationship, or does it really simply benefit, a very, very tiny portion of the American population? And as you could probably see from the grilling of Mr. Geithner and the very odd and peculiar decision by Mr. Barney Frank last night not to go and vote on the proposed regulatory overhaul because of allegedly he got cornered by members of the Black Caucus who told him that there are unwilling to vote up until such time as a lot of the complaints that they've been getting from their own constituents do not get resolved vis-a-vis unemployment. Hmm. So it's very interesting that even within the Democratic Party now, you are seeing all these very odd splinter, you know, factions that are making it more and more an issue whether or not the administration, especially through Mr. Geithner and Bernanke, is focused on merely bailing out Wall Street and the kleptocracy or whatever you want to call them, or are they actually focusing on helping out Main Street? And, you know, we can only say unemployment is a lagging factor so long before, you know, you hit 12-13% unemployment right about the time when you have midterm elections.
Right.
And, you know, if the unemployment rate continues growing at the current rate, and, you know, one can also make the assumption that the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is actually very aggressively manipulating this data, courtesy of, you know, not only birth death adjustments, but, you know, a lot of other kind of statistical...
Oh, revisions. The thing that just gets me is the revisions. The revisions,
well, the revisions
are just beautiful.
Yeah, I know, you're absolutely right. And Charles Biederman of TrendTask has done some very, you know, very good studies on this. And keep in mind that the BLS itself announced, I believe a month and a half ago, that in February or March, they will have to add, I believe, 830,000 more people to their, adjusted number of unemployed people in America. So that's, you know, in another, I don't know, 0.7%, 0.8%. Mm-hmm. of unemployment rates. So,
right.
Unfortunately, 2010, from my point of view, isn't looking good. And this goes back to your original question, you know, why am I bearish in the economy? And whether or not the economy has any bearing on the stock market. Now, you know, one of the ironic things that we've experienced is the most ridiculous decoupling between the stock market and the economy. Granted, you know, the stock market is a forward-looking indicator, et cetera, but there is absolutely nothing in the economy that indicates that when you take away the stimulus, the constant stimulus, whether it's in the form of, you know, the original stimulus, the stack stimulus, cash for clunkers, from a fiscal policy point of view, or quantitative easing from a monetary policy point of view, that things will get better. And the scariest thing from my perspective, you know, where I look at things from, is that if you were to look at where interest rates should be right now based on the Taylor rule, which... I don't know if you're familiar with
that. Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. Yeah, it's where it should be and inflation. It basically, looking at inflation and where things are and growth and all that, right?
Exactly. It's simply an estimation based on current economic conditions of what the current interest rate should be. And based on, I believe, I read the formula a few days ago, the interest rate should be at -6.5, if I'm not mistaken, which is probably the lowest it's ever been. Worse even than it was in February or March when quantitative easing was starting. So, you know, absent the Federal Reserve, you know, totally changing its posture and actually starting to charge people to keep deposits and banks as well, the whole deflationary threat is, you know, very, very real and very, very tangible.
You know, could you do me a favor? I know you use a Bloomberg, right? You Bloomberg?
Yes.
There's a Taylor rule calculator on that, right? Do you use that?
I'm sorry?
There's a Taylor rule calculator on that.
Yes.
Can you put it up and then give it to me and we'll put it on the website?
Absolutely. Okay. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I'll send it to you ASAP.
Yep. All right, let's switch gears because there's so many things to talk about here. But FHA, close to, if not at the end of their rope when it comes to their reserve requirement. As a matter of fact, they're way past it. This is one of the things that happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where they were supposed to have, way back when, I think they had a 20% corridor requirement way back when, how much they could have on loan and how much they can have required to have in reserves, obviously, and it was a leveraging issue, you know, that's obvious. Then they went down to some ridiculous number like 5%, and then they imploded,
yes.
Right? And they didn't change that because why change a rule that is bad for the, you know, bad for everybody if as long as everything's okay. If nobody, you know, the old, we could say a bear, but we'll use the tree. If a tree falls in the woods, nobody hears it. Well, if FHA is right. Fine for a while, what do we care what the reserve requirements are? But they are at, what, a 2% number now, I think it is. And is that serious?
Right, yes. Well, vis-a-vis the FHA, I will probably have to point you to the testimony that I think Edward Pento put up before the House Congressional Committee or House Financial Services Committee, I think about a month ago, I believe, in which he said that the FHA, Edward Pentel, I believe, was a chief risk officer at either Fannie or Freddie for many years. Mm-hmm. He's currently not affiliated with anybody, so he can be relatively objective. And he said that the shortfall of the FHA is roughly $50 billion right now. And this doesn't even take into consideration the ongoing deterioration in delinquencies and foreclosures, REOs, et cetera. The FHA, really, what it has done is it has taken the place of all the private subprime lenders that obviously brought the system down to its knees. And the FHA, in many ways, is in the same condition as New Century, as American Home Lender, all those companies that went bankrupt virtually overnight, which it would do too unless it had the Federal Reserve backing up and buying all the GSE mortgages. And, you know, kind of going back to quantitative examples, one thing I'd like to point out to you and your listeners, I looked at the Federal Reserve H-4-1 statement, which comes out every week, which shows how many treasuries, how many mortgage-backed securities, how many agencies the Fed purchases every single week, roughly, or, you know, every single week, basically. And while the Fed no longer is purchasing treasuries, courtesy of quantitative easing, that program expired on October 31st, it still has roughly $200-300 billion, I believe, of MBS and another $100 billion of agencies left for acquisition purposes. And just from last week to this week, so from last Thursday to this Thursday, the Fed purchased $70 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. That's enough to run, you know, however you quantify, you know, cash for clunkers, but roughly seven programs of cash for clunkers.
Yeah, and that's going right, and then that's being spit out into probably helping to make sure that FHA doesn't tumble and that there's extra money available for any kind of lending that's going on. Obviously, you know, we're back to where low margin requirement, or low home to loan, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Loan to value.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Loan to value. I'm so excited about this. This stuff gets me crazy and scrambles my head. The loan to value is they're selling houses again for 5%. I mean, well, you know, we're just going back. It just seems like we've never learned. I don't get it.
Well, you know, one of the take home observation from all this really is that the Fed right now is the buyer of last resort for housing related securities, for, you know, Fannie and Freddie and mortgage backed securities. If you were to take away the Fed, there would be nobody willing to buy mortgages,
right?
30-year mortgages at these rates. Now, a 30-year mortgage, the last time I looked, was, you know, the traditional 30-year Fannie cash pay was 4.8%, which is it's simply the most ludicrous interest rate for a security that is backed by housing that has LTV of, you know, over one.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the people who are residing there are either basically doing sell leasebacks with the FHA. In other words, the instead of being booted, I don't know if you recall seeing this, but the FHA allowed people to recently...
You can live there. You can live there. Stay a while. Don't worry. We're not throwing you out.
Correct. So you have that. You have, you know, cash flow, you know, collections that are declining every single month, you know, because on the other hand, the unemployment number isn't getting any better. So it's already very intertwined. And all that the Federal Reserve is doing, it's this very visible hand that is propping up, on one hand, the 30-year mortgage rate, and thanks to that, it's also propping up U.S. Treasury rates because it's very, you know, linked.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, once quantitative easing is done in March of 2010, you know, absent Bernanke saying, you know, we need another program of monetary stimulus. And actually, if you were to listen to Meredith Whitney's Bloomberg Radio interview from yesterday, this is the one thing that she said that, you know, keeps her awake at night.
Did you see her recently on a CNBC thing where she was actually the bearish she's ever been?
I did see that interview. I have
she looked terrible.
Respect for Meredith.
She looked terrible, didn't she? She looked awful.
listen, you know, more power to her. I think that
she's very smart. Yeah, she's very smart. She's great.
She looks. You know, she turned 40 yesterday, so I
imagine
her age is gradually catching up with her.
Uh-huh.
But You know, I, all else being equal, I disagree with her on some things. I actually totally agree with her on the mortgage-backed securities issue. That, you know, once you were to take away this, you know, massive purchaser of what will have been $1.5 trillion worth of MBS and agencies when we hit, you know, March and April of next year, then who is going to buy this stuff?
Well, the government knows that. They're not going to just pull it out and pull the rug from under. They can't. They can't, can they?
Oh, you're absolutely right. However, that will come at a very political cost because, mm-hmm. you know, you're getting to a point where people are not, you know, they're actually getting very educated. You know, one of the main reasons I started Zero Hedge is to try to educate people on all these very nuanced relationships between all the different facets of the economy. And, you know, hopefully I've brought some of this to at least those who are interested and curious by it. But, you know, this is money that could very easily be flowing into fiscal programs that even, you know, considering who's in public, which should be a very, you know, liberal power, is in essence just doing everything it can to stabilize Wall Street and essentially is pursuing a very pro-Republican agenda, which is the most ironic thing in the world.
Yeah.
Now, you know, many people have asked, you know, Zero Hedge, what is the proper policy here? And, you know, unfortunately, the biggest problem is that we have, ever since we started the whole bailout track with, first of all, the GSEs, and rather even before that, when we bailed out Bear Stearns, basically, and you know, ironically, letting Lehman fall was a step in the right direction. But, you know, what they realize is that this whole contraption, this whole financial monster, which has 1.3 quadrillion in, you know, excess liquidity out there, in courtesy of you know, over-the-counter and exchange-traded derivatives, swaps, futures, etc., that whole thing would have collapsed and collided and, you know, evaporated the system. So instead of the administration and the regulators trying to find a way to moderate this and to, you know, trim it down in any way they can, all they're trying to do is basically, you know, recreate the bubble. And that's unsustainable. So I took a quick look at the Bank of International Settlements, which is basically the Federal Reserve, Fed, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And while in the second-to-last report, it's a biannual report that basically lists out all the outstanding derivatives. The total amount had dropped, and this is only for OTC, so if you were to add regulated or exchange-traded derivatives, you probably would get double the number. But the number had fallen to roughly $550 trillion, and this is mostly interest rate swaps, CDS, foreign currency swaps, futures, etc. Now,
well, it dropped from where? What was the number prior?
Well, it had peaked, I believe, at roughly $650 trillion at some point in late 2007, early 2008.
That's a lot of smile. So that's a lot of bread there.
Oh yeah, so I mean, it did drop, but the scariest thing is that as of the latest reading, the total gross notional actually went up by another 15%, I think, as of the last report, which came out last Thursday, and it's back to over $600 trillion now. So nothing has changed. The fine gentlemen at the Basel Committee for Risk Regulation are doing absolutely nothing to make sure that, you know, risk can be contained and regulated, and everybody's basically, you know, They've hugged their heads and they're hoping that the crash landing is going to be, you know, a little bit better this time than it was last time. We are not doing anything at all to make sure that we can survive another crash if and when it does happen.
Yeah, no, I agree with
so
that.
Many, the, you know, the problem is there are so many catalytical events that can occur now that would, you know, obliterate the system once again overnight. I mean, probably the most salient one is what we have been basically discussing over the past 3 months. Nouria Roubini finally caught on to it a couple of weeks ago, basically the whole dollar carry trade, which is, in essence, every single financial institution and central bank in the world is short the dollar now. And another report by the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, estimated that the total amount of potential underfunding between dollar shorts outstanding, as well as a funding shortfall due to the duration mismatch of various dollar-denominated assets that make up every single international firm's balance sheets, is roughly $6.5 trillion. In other words, if and when there is a squeeze, a short squeeze on the dollar, there will be a hole of almost $6 trillion that needs to be plugged. Now, last time around, what happened was the Fed went out and sent basically half $1 trillion in foreign currency swaps to all the central banks to bail them out, because every single bank all of a sudden found itself at a massive dollar short position when the dollar spiked from, I think, 72, 73 on the XC to 85, 86. In other words, the risk aversion trade manifested itself in a huge spike in the dollar value. This was around the time that Lehman blew up. We still have the fundamental structural deficiency, which has to do with the maturity mismatch of various dollar-denominated assets. But now, on top of everything, we have everybody basically piling into the dollar short courtesy of the Fed's 0% interest rate policy.
Yeah, here's my theory on this. Tell me what you think, because you'll probably tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about here, but because it's very, very difficult and very it's intertwined, and it's also very difficult to grasp the relationship of why the stocks are being so highly correlated. But the best I can come up with is that because of the dollar being so low and because of the low cost to borrow, the amount of leverage that's being used is astronomical, utilized, being put back into the market and actually being used to liquidate the positions. And then that's put into the market and things move up. When the dollar does move against them, the market's moving, obviously, there's an equilibrium that breaks. And what's happening is it's almost like they need to make sure that money that they're making on that, we'll call it the arbitrage, so to speak, of the dollar and stocks is very easily put into the wrong position, you know, and that's why we see this relationship happening, and it needs to be kept in equilibrium, if you will, right? So when it goes out of whack, that's when we see these gigantic smacks down. In fact, we're seeing volume has been consistently on the down. It's almost like a scared move. Every single time that we see a down, the volume is much greater than the up rally markets, because up the rallying markets can be much greater. There's a much greater ability to profit, obviously, in that transaction and to keep it in equalization. But once it turns against them and the dollar starts moving, you get a double whammy on it. And my concern is if we do see a dollar move up, because, you know, and the reason the correlation is high is because that is basically a, let's call it a multiple leverage trade that's being done that becomes very, very unstable very quickly. Does that make any sense?
That makes perfect sense. And actually, I have done practical studies on this. And look, I've compared the beta for the market on dollar up days and dollar down days. And for example, when the dollar was still relatively rich, in other words, in the 80 to 85 range, any 1% move in the dollar, for example, would have correlated or translated into roughly a comparable move in the equity market. So basically, 1% move up in the dollar would have been a 1% move down in the market, etc., and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the further that the dollar has depreciated or gotten devalued, any incremental move lower in the dollar has a more and more marginally declining impact on the market higher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, what has become obvious is that the opposite is becoming more and more pronounced. So in other words, a move up in the dollar has a much more pronounced impact on the equities or the equity market lower than a move lower in the dollar has on equities higher. And I think the ratio now is almost 2-1. So, you know, to your point, we are almost getting to the point where the marginal utility of the leverage when it comes to the carry trade or however you want to specify it is getting exhausted. And we're going to get to a point where, you know, if we keep pushing the dollar lower and lower, even by whacking the dollar, you know, by 1%, 2%, it's going to have almost no impact on the equities, precisely because of what you pointed out, which is that the essentially all assets are trading as one almost.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the market, it's all one big beta trade. There is almost no alpha opportunity whatsoever. The only alpha out there is if you catch a short squeeze in progress. Very few stocks trade on fundamentals because nobody really believes that any of these fundamental numbers that we're seeing, which are anywhere between 20 and 50 times forward PE multiples. When you look at Amazon, which is trading at, 80 to 90 depending on the
There was a good piece on that this week that talked about how there is no way that this stock should be valued at this level, even though they're a great company and all the things that are going on. But the potential, it's the old story about Dell and Amazon being a different situation. But you know what? When they were pricing Dell at the height of where it was, and by the way, Dell came out this week with some horrendous numbers and dropped the stock by 10-12%. But when Dell was being priced for perfection, it was like you had to have four desktops on every single person's desk. And that just was, you know, because the growth rates, obviously, over time from a company that's, you know, this size, and then it multiplies by two, and then it multiplies by two. And of course, it starts growing and growing and growing and exponentially growing. But then you get into a situation where growth is like Walmart. You know, we like Walmart, but, you know, Walmart just doesn't have that growth rate anymore. Microsoft doesn't have that growth rate anymore like Apple does.
You're absolutely right. And you know, what I can tell you as pertains to Amazon, it's all a fad, basically, that's kind of fabricated right now, courtesy of the whole Kindle e-reader e-book concept. Everybody's gotten into it now. You know, if you followed, I think Sony announced yesterday that they basically run out of pre-buy orders for their version of the Kindle. And Barnes & Noble today said that, you know, they're no longer accepting Christmas requests for their version of the Kindle. Ironically, you know, America still has the worst educational system in the world. So, you know, if everybody's ordering, you know, three of the same, you know, electronic book modules, who the hell is reading this? And yes, you know, granted, it's like a fad. It's you know, passing, you know, interest until, you know, one of the two happens. Either you get a lot of competition and your, you know, primary market economy of scale is diluted courtesy of everybody getting involved, because the, you know, barriers to entry are very minimal. You know, you can make one of these things in Singapore for, you know, $5 a pop. There's no cost associated whatsoever. And you know, does Amazon really have this huge, you know, competitive advantage courtesy of its existing library? It's, you know, it's almost like whether or not the iPhone will be the one end-all be-all, you know, I guess, you know, multi-purpose PDA out there in perpetuity just because it has an open
just
market.
Has the market. Yeah, just because it has the market now. Listen, there was a time that, you know, that the Compaq had the market on portable luggables. It's not there anymore. It was a time that Motorola had the corner. Nokia had the corner, although Nokia is still big, but still not profitable like it should be. But Motorola, I mean, Motorola almost went out of business, let's be honest. And listen, there was a time that Wetson's was one of the best burgers around. But you know what? Have you heard about Wetson's? You know a Wetson's? Have you ever been to a Wetson's?
No.
No, they're out of business, okay? So the point is that, you know, some things change. I mean, listen, who would have thought that General Motors would be where it is, you know, right now? But, you know, we can go on forever this. I really want to talk about Sheila Bair. I'm going to ask you this question very quickly because we want to wrap up. It's kind of late here in the show. But do you think that – is it that me or – is Sheila Bair the only sane one in this group?
Well, Sheila Bair seems to be appreciating the real – you know, danger, because she is really at the brunt of what would happen if, let's say, tomorrow the FDIC were to announce, you know, we had a bank failure, but we couldn't pay for it. All the public anger would bypass Geithner, would bypass Bernanke, would bypass Obama, and would go straight to Sheila Bair because it's her agency. And I would say that of all the agencies out there that are most in trouble, the FDIC is probably by far the, you know, the worst example.
And it also looks to me that they would throw her under the bus pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. It's no secret to anybody that she has probably one of the worst relationships with the other regulators, especially with Mr. Geithner. Mary Shapiro, who is always, you know, always at these regulatory meetings, she's, you know, totally incompetent, and she's, you know, a perpetual mute. She has no opinion on anything, because, frankly, I'm shocked that she managed to get to where she is currently with the SEC. there must be obviously a very, you know, extensive backstory there, but
And by the way, Sheila Bair is the head of the FDIC, if anybody that doesn't know that, and has been vehemently against taking government money from the FDIC, is coming up with all sorts of interesting ways for the banks to try to pay for the bailout, and we'll see what happens, because they're trying to consolidate some of this, and it looks like that, you know, we're she's in a job and out of a job almost every day, depending on what the future is going to be of one regulatory agency or not, or whether we go with the Dodd plan or Frank, or, I mean, it's just, to be honest with you, it's a circus right now with Congress in terms of all the things that they're trying to juggle. And the latest thing I heard was that someone was requesting that the clerk reads out loud the entire 1,200 pages or so of the health care bill before any vote can happen.
Listen,
that's crazy.
Again, our political situation is just in total shambles, and you could see that probably clear more so than anywhere else at the Geithner hearing yesterday. But, you know, to going back to your question about the FDIC, I think the biggest issue, the biggest risk is, you know, what happens if, again, we have another systemic risk flare event?
Yeah.
And, you know, the one thing to keep in mind, you know, from a legal standpoint is we have a Treasury federal debt ceiling, rather, of $12.5 trillion. We just passed $12 trillion, you know, I believe 2 days ago. So we only have $100 billion less in capacity to raise debt. And at the rate that, you know, the deficit is growing, we are probably going to pass that within, you know, a month or so. The problem is that one way, and, you know, this has been the traditional fallback plan for the FDIC, is, you know, they have this line of credit with the Treasury. However, any incremental debt that is levied on the Treasury will actually have to come out of the total ceiling. Now, you know, our run rate of FDIC bailouts is somewhere to the tune of, you know, $5 to $10 billion a week, meaning that we are getting to a point where, unless Congress moves to vote very, very quickly on raising the debt ceiling once again, and, you know, judging by how, you know, inefficient the clowns in Washington are right now, this is not going to happen for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But we are getting dangerously close to where, you know, you need to fund the deficit, and you need to potentially even fund the FDIC, which, as we know, is currently insolvent based on their most recent disclosure. They themselves said that as of September 30th, or rather as of October 1st, they have, you know, a negative equity balance.
Mm.
So these are all things that just, you know, should keep anybody who cares up, you know, very much at night, every single night.
Yeah. Well, this is what we're going to do. I mean, there's a lot to chew on here, and obviously there's a lot we have to look for because it's all developing, and maybe there could be a plan that comes on one day and things do turn a bit, but right now the continuing spending is obviously causing some problems. So you are a you're a great insight on this, and of course everybody should visit Zero Hedge. We'll put the link on the site. I have to ask you a question. You know, those podcast awards, the nomination. I don't know if I told you this, but we were nominated for the People's Choice Award as well as the Business. I was pretty surprised about that, which is pretty good. Yeah. There was a ton of them. Now I know a lot of people are listening. They come to listen to you, and what do you need to tell them? Don't you think that they should go right now to podcastawards.com? And vote for who?
They should, of course, vote for this one investor. We actually did put a link up on Zero Hedge for that some time ago. I believe a lot of my readers did use that opportunity to express their appreciation of your website. I think that, you know, the quality of your audience speaks for itself. And I believe podcasts, in many ways, are the wave of the future when it comes to audible media. Frankly, you know, at least so far, Andrew, you haven't gone too crazy with the commercial breaks, which I think is, you know, terrific, you know, a huge benefit for everybody involved.
Yep, I hear you. So this is what I want you to do. Just everybody go over to podcast. What happened is we got nominated. Now it's the voting time. So this is kind of the final through November 30th. Go over to podcastawards.com and put your vote in. Once you do so, you're going to get back an email confirming because they want to make sure no bots are doing anything weird, and just confirm it. You can actually vote once per day. For once every 24 hours, once per day, and you do that through the 30th. And boy, oh boy, if I get one of those awards for one, actually, all three of my podcasts made it. We had the Winning Investor, which is the one through Quick and Dirty Tips, is on for education, business, DH Unplugged, which I do, and the Disciplined Investor are in the running, and the Disciplined Investor for the People's Choice, which, boy, there's a thick group there that's going to be tough to get through. So. We'll put the information, and Tyler, you're going to send me the information on the Taylor Rule, and we'll put that up on the site, and I encourage you to definitely do that. There goes my phone off. Look at that phone. Yeah, we're going to turn that off. That's a buddy of mine puts out those phone ringers. How unprofessional. But I thank you very much for doing this, and I thank you for all the things that you do, and I do wish you that one day you'll actually get some sleep. Because it's very clear to me that putting up the amount of research and posts that you do and the amount of reading, there is no anybody that's on your staff, they can't be sleeping. So, you know, if Red Bull ever comes out as a stock, we'll probably buy it just on your obvious intake.
No, unfortunately, Red Bull is smart. They, from what I understand, they never want to IPO, and they forever want to keep a very private profile.
Good for them. Smart.
Unfortunately, there will be no way for me to participate in the equity upside there, but I appreciate the kind words.
All right, Tyler Durden, well, again, from Zero Hedge, that's really the place. to go for if you want to know the inside scoop and the back stories of what's going on. And by the way, you'll be interested in this. Andrew Ross Sorkin will be on the... Have you read his book yet, by the way? Have you seen his book?
I have not.
Looks pretty interesting.
I'm sure it has received very good recommendations by a lot of people, yes.
It's pretty ugly what he... I mean, he hits pretty hard on a few of these guys. I mean, he gets down and dirty. Anyway, he's going to be on the show in about 2 weeks from now. So he's going to talk about this. Book is a little bit thick, 600 pages. I need a little time to get through that. Maybe I'll do it on the Kindle or my Nook. Who knows? Anyway, thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And that's all we have for this week. We're going to sign off. The show ran a little bit long. I hope that you have a great week. And you'll be listening to this through the Thanksgiving week. And make sure that you spend some time thinking about what's going on. Watch the banks. Watch the markets. I wish you all well. Have a happy turkey and have a happy week. We'll see you next week with some exciting things on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.